I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the first formal news conference of his second term, President Bush reiterated his call for freedom around the world, and he urged Iraqis to participate in Sunday's election, despite attacks that are intimidating voters. The president also said that the Marine helicopter crash in Iraq today that killed 31 people is being investigated.
The story today is going to be very discouraging to the American people. I understand that. We value life. And we weep and mourn when soldiers lose their life. But it is the long-term objective that is vital, and that is to spread freedom.
And President Bush declined to give a timetable for withdrawing from Iraq.
We will complete the mission as quickly as possible. And that mission of a secure and stable Iraq will be achieved when the Iraqis are fighting the former regime elements and people like Zarqawi. Therefore, it is important that we continue to press forward with proper training.
On the domestic front, the president was peppered with questions about congressional resistance to his plan to reform Social Security by creating private investment accounts.
I am going to continue to speak directly to the American people about this issue and remind them about the math and remind them that if you're a senior, nothing changes, and speak to the younger folks coming up about the forecasts. I mean, if you're a 20-year-old person and you look at the math, you realize that you will inherit a bankrupt system.
And the president testily defended two of his most controversial cabinet picks, Attorney General nominee Alberto Gonzalez, who was confirmed in committee this morning, and Condoleezza Rice, who came under fire from Senate Democrats on floor debate yesterday and today.
Condi Rice is a fine, fine public servant, greatly admired here in America and greatly admired around the world. And she will make a great Secretary of State.
Rice is expected to begin work at the State Department tomorrow. The president took questions today for about an hour. It was his 18th formal news conference to date. Well, now for a check-in in London, where the head of police says the four British citizens just released from Guantanamo Bay prison will be freed unless new evidence is presented against them. The men were flown to Britain yesterday, where they were arrested under a provision of Britain's Terrorism Act. They were among about 550 prisoners from 42 countries who were swept up in the U.S. war on terrorism and detained without charge in Cuba. Here now is Michael Goldfarb, joins us from London. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Robin.
And tell us, first of all, who are these four?
Well, these four men are the last of the British citizens who were detained at Guantanamo Bay. Feroz Abbasi, Richard Belmar, Muazzam Beg, and Martin Mubanga were all taken either from Pakistan or Afghanistan in 2001 and brought to Guantanamo Bay. Their detention has become a real sore point between the Blair government and the Bush administration. There was a lot of pressure over here to get these men released. And finally, it's all happened very suddenly. It was, I think, just 2 weeks ago that it was announced that their release was imminent. And then yesterday they were flown without any warning at all. I mean, they were just simply flown back. The announcement was made while they were in the air from Cuba to Britain.
And they were immediately arrested when they landed in London. What is the chance that any new evidence will be found against them or that an admission will come from them, given that they were at Guantanamo for so long?
Well, not much. Law here states that any confessions made under duress or torture, and all four men claim to have been tortured, is just simply inadmissible in court. So there won't be much new. And then there's the practical thing that even if these men were members of Al-Qaeda or any other kind of international Islamic terrorist group, they've been on Cuba for so long, they couldn't possibly have any operational knowledge. I mean, they've been held in isolation, and consequently, they wouldn't have much new to say. What happened last year in March when the previous group of Britons was released is they were detained upon arrival at Paddington Green Police Station for about 24 hours, and then the police let them go, saying they had no case to answer.
And what has happened to those five Britons who as you said, were released from Guantanamo and released in London. Where are they now?
All five were offered therapeutic services at the Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture here in London, and one of them is still receiving those services, and all of them have been allowed to go about trying to resume their lives in privacy.
Michael, while we have you, I want to ask about another story out of Britain. Belmarsh Prison has been called the British Gitmo. In 2001, 12 foreign nationals were put in the prison in London. They were held under anti-terror laws. It's been announced today they're going to be released. Why?
Back in December, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that the conditions of their detention contravened European law. It's an interesting thought that this should all happen together. With the release today of the last British citizens from Guantanamo Bay, it's no coincidence, I think, that this was the day that the Home Secretary, Britain's cabinet legal supremo, if you will, the Home Secretary, decided that Belmarsh would be closed.
Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Now to the Middle East, where, according to press reports, Israel may be about to withdraw from four West Bank cities. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas has ordered his security chiefs to get ready to assume control of the towns of Jericho, Ramallah, Tulkarm, and Qalqilia within the next 10 days. This comes from Palestinian sources and has not been confirmed by Israeli officials. But if true, it's one of several developments in recent days. Joining us from Jerusalem is Matt Reese. He's a Time magazine correspondent and author of Cain's Field, Faith, Fratricide, and Fear in the Middle East. And Matt, let's start with these reports that Israel may be ready to withdraw from these four key West Bank cities. What would be the significance of this?
It would be the first sign that Israel is recognizing the success of the new Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, in reining in the militants. He's already acted in Gaza, and this would be the first sign that the Israelis are prepared to move their troops back in the West Bank. They've been in those towns since early 2002 when they went in to operate against suicide bombers. Since then, they've been either in the town or around the edge of it. Essentially, this would not mean that they'd be withdrawing in a major way. They'd just be loosening up on some of the checkpoints, moving back from some of their positions, but more to the point, they'd be letting the Palestinian police do the security job in these towns. The last couple of years, Palestinian police have essentially been frightened to move about in their uniforms and with their guns because they figured they could turn the wrong way somewhere and run into an Israeli tank. So they didn't want to be around dressed like that and operating. That's the real significance.
We hear there's also progress in talks between militant groups like Hamas, the Palestinian government, and the Israeli government. Tell us about that.
The basic strategy that the new Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, is trying to follow is to bring them inside the political process. So the Israelis are recognizing that right now and trying to give him a little something to offer Hamas to bring them inside. And that's this question of assassinations, or as the Israelis call them, targeted interceptions or targeted killings. Hamas won't do any kind of deal with Mahmoud Abbas if they feel like as soon as they put their weapons down, Israel can at any time knock off one of its existing leaders. Many of them have already been killed, and they're very wary about seeming to be the ones who back down. So what Israel seems to be doing, not publicly, but behind the scenes, is signaling to Mahmoud Abbas that he can tell Hamas, we are going to think twice before we carry out any of these assassinations, and we are going to give you, the Palestinian Authority, the responsibility of essentially doing the job that we've been doing up to now, stopping the suicide bombers.
In fact, we've read some reports today that say that Israel has said outright that it will suspend targeted killings of Hamas leaders and other people a day after Hamas said that it would also cease fire. Is it not as clear-cut to you?
it's not that clear-cut. It's a good sign, but it's not an absolute guarantee that there won't be any more such attacks.
Hmm. Well, another note from the Mideast. Tomorrow there will be a round of municipal elections in Gaza. It's the second of two rounds. And the terrorist group Hamas is again fielding candidates, again, to people in the Palestinian lands. They're seen as a social welfare group. But are they expected to do well?
They are, particularly as it's in Gaza. These 10 municipalities are in Gaza, and that's where Hamas is at its strongest. Although we can't read too much into these local elections because people often vote on the basis of their clan, it is significant because this is what President Abbas wants to do with Hamas. He wants to bring them inside the political process. And if we look into the future, in July they have parliamentary elections. That's really important for him to continue his negotiations with Hamas and to make sure that they run in those elections. He believes once Hamas is dealing with, making sure that the sewage works and that there are services in a municipality, once they are sitting in the parliament, they will effectively be neutralized as a terrorist organization.
We're going to talk more about what seems to be a transition here for Hamas from a terror organization to a political entity. But just your point of view, how is that transition being viewed by Palestinians, by Israelis, by you?
By Palestinians, it's very favorably, because what they've had over the last few years is extreme internal divisions with Hamas operating against the Palestinian Authority, against the wishes of the Palestinian Authority sometimes. They've had a leader, Arafat, who died in November, who was ready to play different groups off against other groups, and they've had the Israeli army in their towns, on their streets, and fighting pitched battles in their neighborhoods. So they're very keen that Hamas should become part of the political process because, first of all, that will mean the possibility of diplomatic gains for the Palestinians in vis-a-vis Israel. It'll also mean that Hamas, which is seen as a very ethical and clean party, whatever you think of their terrorism, they are not seen as corrupt. Hamas will become part of the political system, and that will help the independents in the political system who are trying to fight against the corruption of the Palestinian Authority. Certainly Israelis are very skeptical about Hamas, but if they feel that Mahmoud Abbas is bringing Hamas into the political system, is getting these concessions, like in the last week he reports that Hamas has been prepared to accept Israel's existing borders rather than going back to the borders of 1948 and various other things like that, they'll see that as a good sign, and they will be prepared to cut President Abbas quite a lot of slack in the coming month.
Matt Rees, Jerusalem correspondent for Time magazine, author of the book Cain's Field. Matt, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
And when we come back, more on the possibility, inconceivable to many, that Hamas may be transitioning from terror to politics. There's much more coming up here and now. Stay with us. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation about recent news from the Middle East and the possibility that the terrorist group Hamas may be making a transition, inconceivable to many, to a mainstream political party. Chaim Malka is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Chaim, you've been studying precisely this question. Do you and other experts see the beginning of a transformation of Hamas?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it that Hamas is in a process of transitioning to a political movement. But with that said, I think it's important to understand that Hamas has not given up its military wing, nor is it intending at the moment to disarm itself. So it sees itself as transitioning into the Palestinian political system, but at the same time reserving it the right to carry out resistance if need be in the future.
And in the past, it's been pretty brutal resistance. Hamas has been responsible for horrific terrorist attacks on civilian targets inside Israel. Remind us of one or two.
Absolutely. Well, the most recent was in Jerusalem last January, where a number of worshippers returning from the Western Wall were killed, and there were a number of children killed in that attack as well. I believe it. Around a dozen people. So that was one of the attacks that sort of led to another flare-up of violence. But Hamas has been responsible since the mid-90s for a series of very deadly and precise suicide bombings.
Right. So what are the prospects of people not overlooking that, but forgiving that? And by the people, I mean both Palestinians and Israelis, because we understand that, polls within Palestinian territory show that they're pretty tired of the violence as well.
Absolutely. I think people on both sides are very tired of the violence, and they want real change. And I think this is a sign of political maturation within the political system being created by the new system being created by Mahmoud Abbas in Palestine. And I think Israelis are skeptical of this transition of Hamas, because Hamas has still not given up its stated goal of liberating all of Palestine and creating an Islamic State. So,
I want to stop you there for a second, because how do you square that with the document released this week by Hamas saying that they unequivocally recognize the 1967 borders?
Well, that's precisely the question. This is not the first time that Hamas officials have vaguely recognized the 1967 borders. In fact, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, in the last several years, had declared that he would also recognize a Palestinian state along the 1967 borders as an interim step to achieving the liberation of all of Palestine.
And we should point out that by their definition, that means all of Israel.
Exactly. All of the Palestine Mandate, which was under occupation by the British.
Right. So how does this get resolved?
Well, that's the question, and I think Hamas needs to work it out first and foremost. And I don't think that it's clear at the moment that they have resolved that that conflict.
Right. And ironically, there were Hamas leaders who were talking about coming to terms with Israel but were killed.
That's true. Ishmael Abu Shanab was killed last year in a targeted assassination, and a lot of people, even on the Israeli side, criticized that that assassination because they felt that Abu Shanab was someone who was a pragmatic leader in Hamas and that who could be dealt with in the past. But I think there are a lot of other pragmatic Hamas leaders at the moment that also feel that they could accept a 1967 Palestinian state along the 1967 borders.
Yeah. These are obviously considerable questions to overcome, but you started off by saying that you thought that absolutely Hamas was making a transformation from a militant group to a political party. How does that work? Where do we look anywhere else to see how that might work? I'm thinking South Africa, Ireland.
Absolutely. The ANC definitely was a movement that was committed to the armed struggle in the 1950s and 60s and then transitioned to a political process and became a political party. The IRA, I think, is a better example, because what you had was a split with the provisional IRA army that rejected the Good Friday Agreement. And I think that's what we may be seeing in the future with Hamas. There may be a faction which is co-opted by Mahmoud Abbas and enters the political system, and there could be another faction which becomes more radicalized and rejects the agreement and will continue the armed struggle against Israel. If that's the case, Abbas will have to make a decision whether he's going to confront that military wing.
I was just going to ask you that. Would that hardliner wing then have to be rejected by Abbas?
Absolutely. When the time is right, when he is able to consolidate his power, he will have no choice but to move against them.
Chaim, is it possible that there might be a future in the Middle East where you have those hardliners, those Palestinians who might rail against Israel, call for the end of Israel, but not act on it, and still function in a Palestinian government, in much in the way their counterparts in the Israeli parliament, let's say in the Knesset, call for all Palestinians to be shipped to Jordan? They call for it, but they don't act on it. Might you see that future?
Absolutely, and I think that Hamas itself recognizes that it doesn't necessarily have to give up its overall strategic goal of liberating Palestine. They can maintain the rhetoric, but they don't have to engage in armed resistance and terror attacks against Israel. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be a major achievement and step as well.
Chaim, you know that there are Israelis who are hearing this conversation, even the idea that Hamas might be becoming a political party, and they cannot believe it or accept it because of the violent past. What makes you think that it's possible. And do you understand that thinking?
Absolutely. I think it's difficult to overcome the psychological barrier of Hamas becoming a political party and being involved in negotiations. But I think for the future of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and for the future of the peace process and the final agreement, Hamas and militants must be included in Palestinian decision-making and even negotiations with Israel. It will stabilize negotiations and ensure that any agreement that is actually reached between the two sides will be enforceable. And I think Israelis can look back at their own history and look at their own former prime ministers, Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, who did engage in terrorist acts and violence against the British occupation in the 1940s, and then transitioned from a militant organization outside of mainstream Israeli politics into political parties and eventually became prime ministers of their country.
Chaim Malka is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Chaim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, women in the military, they're getting closer and closer to combat. And anti-Semitism in Europe, 60 years after the liberation of Auschwitz. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Academics are still parsing the president's inaugural address. Many of his supporters have applauded President Bush for couching foreign policy in biblical terms. But critics say he was speaking in code to his more religious constituents, in one case quoting the prophet Isaiah without acknowledging it. Isaiah said in the Bible that the Spirit of God was upon him to proclaim liberty to the captives. The president spoke of setting the captives free. Even conservative speechwriter Peggy Noonan called the speech way too much God. Well, President Bush begins each day with a prayer and a Bible reading, so the fact that he brought his born-again Methodist faith into his inaugural address isn't new. But his second inaugural described freedom as a religious calling and the nation's mission.
America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one. From the day of our founding, we have proclaimed that every man and woman on this earth has rights and dignity and matchless value because they bear the image of the Maker of heaven and earth.
Concepts President Bush reiterated today in his first news conference of his second term. Well, joining us on the line is Professor John Green. He's director of the Bliss Institute of Applied Politics at the University of Akron, which studies the relationship between politics and religion. Welcome, Professor.
I'm glad to be with you.
And what was your first reaction when you heard the words that we excerpted above during the president's speech?
Well, you know, I was really quite surprised. I was watching the speech with a number of my students, and I actually found myself standing up because I was quite surprised at the direct connection between theistic beliefs and American policy. Of course, American presidents often talk about religion, mention God in their speeches, particularly in inaugural speeches, but this very direct connection between God's purposes and the values of the United States and presumably the policies of the Bush administration, what was a little bit surprising. Usually we don't see that direct a link.
Well, I'm wondering if one of the reasons you don't hear it is that it might send a signal to other countries that freedom can only come with a dollop of a Christian God.
You know, I think that that is a potential problem. It may be a problem in Muslim countries. It may be a problem in much of the underdeveloped world where religious expression is a very important part of politics. If the president tried to correct that impression, I think, a little bit later in the speech where he was very ecumenical in his view of God, mentioning the Jewish faith, the Christian faith, the Quran, and so forth. But, you know, it could also create problems with many of our allies in advanced industrial societies, the Europeans, the Canadians, the Japanese, and so forth, because in those societies, this kind of overt discussion of religion in political matters is just not done. And so there's a real potential for misunderstanding what President Bush is about.
You mentioned that he reached out to other faiths in the speech. We understand Bush was the first president to mention the Quran in an inaugural address. Later in the speech, he seemed to describe a more humble take on America's relationship with God. Let's listen.
We go forward with complete confidence in the eventual triumph of freedom. Not because history runs on the wheels of inevitability. It is human choices that move events. Not because we consider ourselves a chosen nation. God moves and chooses as he wills.
Professor, why do you think this was in the speech when in the next breath, the president referred to God as the author of liberty?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think there's a couple of reasons for it. Some of it may be some genuine religious humility. Also, President Bush has been regularly criticized here and abroad for appearing to equate God's will with the will of his administration. And I think there's an attempt to create some distance there. But clearly, the president believes that the basic values of the United States are grounded in a religious understanding, in God's eternal purposes, and that these, in fact, in some basic sense, apply to everyone.
Yeah. In fact, as we mentioned Peggy Noonan, a conservative speechwriter, and in her words, the speech seemed rather heavenish. It was a God-drenched speech. Can you think of other moments where, you know, a reference to God might have been made that people who are not attending church every Sunday may not have picked up on it?
Well, you know, there was a number of fairly subtle things, as well as some of these very overt things we've been talking about. For instance, at one point he talked about the choices that oppressors might make abroad, and one of the choices being that which is eternally right or eternally moral. I mean, those are references to religion that might not be as clear to someone who was not deeply immersed in their faith. There were a couple of other references, not so much to God, but to positions that are supported by a particular understanding of religion. For instance, there was an oblique reference to abortion when he talked about children have value even if they're unwanted. You know, to some extent, the president, like other politicians, does speak in language that appeals to particular constituencies. That's, I think, what's often meant by speaking in code. Mm-hmm. And I think there was some of that in this speech, as in some of the other speeches the president has made.
What's your sense of that? I mean, how far can a president go in dropping biblical references?
I think the president can go quite far if the references otherwise make sense to people. But as we've seen, there are people who know the scriptures and who react negatively to this type of reference. So presidents have to be very, very careful not to go too far with that. And I think the key is the purpose for which the phrase is used.
Why do you think that this is happening now? Obviously, this is the man who can do this. He's born again. But why do you think he and his speechwriter are feeling that it will be acceptable now?
Well, you know, I think there's a couple of things going on here. One is I think this really reflects who President Bush is. But I think there's something else going on. Religion is a very important part of American politics these days. There are people of more traditional religious views who have been lining up with the Republican Party, and people of less traditional or no religious views lining up more with the Democratic Party. So I think there's a little bit of a political motivation in the use of this language as well.
Before we let you go, anything else jump out at you from the speech?
Well, you know, one thing that did was the fire imagery. You know, at the beginning of the speech, President Bush talked about the period before September 11th. He called it a time of sabbatical. And then he said, and then fire came, you know, which is a very dramatic reference to September 11th. But then at the end of the speech, he talks about how oppressors have lit a fire that is going to rage throughout all of the world. And, you know, if you put those two things together, it's not only a dramatic image, but it's potentially a very frightening image.
Well, the president's line reads, "A fire in the minds of men burns those who fight its progress, and one day this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of the world." Conservative columnist William Safire agrees with you. He wrote, "That line sounds dangerous. Maybe it should have been a fire that will illuminate the dark corners of the world."
Yes, it's a very dramatic imagery. And it could be that this was just a little error in you know, the figurative language in the speech. On the other hand, it could have been on purpose to suggest that, in fact, the struggle for liberty is not an easy one and that it has its costs and its consequences.
John Green teaches political science at the University of Akron in Ohio. Still to come, one man's quest to perform the music that was silenced by Hitler. You're listening to Here and Now. Here in Boston, we're experiencing the second big storm in a week. Only 5 to 8 inches are expected, but that's on top of the 2 to 3 feet dumped by the weekend blizzard. We are in full snow removal mode. The police visited my neighborhood in Cambridge last night. We dug out our sidewalks, creating 5-foot walls on either side of the walk. We stood by our work, feeling pretty good. But, oh no, upon inspection, we were told by the snow police, widen our path to fit city requirements or face a $25 fine. Snow removal is serious business here. Boston Mayor Tom Menino is expected to decide today whether he'll continue to enforce a recently enacted citywide rule that prohibits residents from claiming parking spaces they've cleared of snow. If you live in Phoenix, you may not grasp the importance of this, but putting out a lawn chair or a garbage can to save a dugout parking space is a time-honored tradition in Boston and other congested cities. But Menino banned it earlier this winter, saying city workers should collect the markers people use to claim parking spaces and throw them away in order to ease the parking situation on narrow city streets. But as Here and Now's Audie Cornish reports from the neighborhood of South Boston, many residents are not ready to abandon their longtime foul weather system.
After hours of back-straining shoveling, people like Jack Haney take the honored tradition of saving your hard-earned parking space pretty seriously. Do you plan on saving your space?
You bet your life I am.
How are you going to do it?
I'm going to put a barrel there. Now ask me, what if somebody takes it?
What if somebody takes it?
They're going to have to get 4 new tires, how many windows they have in their cars, which is at least 6, plus they'll probably have to take paint off of the car.
This year, those items like Haney's trash barrel could be hauled away 48 hours after the snow emergency ends under a policy Mayor Tom Menino started enforcing last month. And Haney says he's ready to take on the public works trucks that would carry out the plan. In fact, he's so fired up about the policy, Haney says he'll be running for mayor himself this fall. And he'd be a welcome addition to the race for nearby shoveler Carol Hunter, who's also annoyed by Menino's plan, especially if the mayor continues to enforce it.
Personally, I think he should stay and live in South Boston or East Boston or Dorchester for a week during the storm and see what it's like, because he's just so wrong. He doesn't know. I mean, he has people driving him, taking care of his driveway and everything else, so he doesn't know what it's like. I personally am not going to vote for him ever again.
Hunter's Honda Civic was identifiable only by its last known position, as snow trucks had buried it fully on their first runs down the street. She knows her plans to claim her space with a metal chair are futile, but she says she won't go the route of some of her neighbors.
So people, instead of waiting for their hazardous waste days, they'll put paint cans or television sets. You have to order a special truck, so when they come and pick these things up after the 48 hours, they just take what's ever there, and you don't have to pay for it or get fined or anything for it.
With a snow emergency and parking ban, the already jam-packed parking situation in neighborhoods like South Boston goes from bad to worse. Residents say they do their part by gingerly walking shovels full of snow to corner snowbanks and off the street. And to South Boston resident Larry Bukes, the old ways work fine. It's the city's policy that's misguided.
I mean, if the city wants to address the parking problem, they should come out 3 weeks after the storm when there's no snow and people are saving the spot, or come out before the snow comes when people are saving the spot. Otherwise, it works around here.
So is the city ready to face off with angry shovelers, or at the very least take on streets full of abandoned hazardous items like televisions, car batteries, or paint cans? Seth Cattell, spokesman for the mayor's office, says Menino has other things on his mind.
Public safety officials have given him a whole panoply of really overriding public safety concerns. And on that list, the issue of space marker or space blocker is at the bottom of that list at this time.
Meanwhile, Cattell says snow removal is continuing, and with more snow forecast for the rest of this week, the city's snow emergency is still in effect.
So be warned, especially if you're visiting Boston, do not remove that folding lawn chair from the dugout parking space. It's not part of some sort of welcome wagon. That report by reporter Audie Cornish. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. American conductor James Conlon is a maestro on a passionate mission to keep alive the music of composers silenced by the Nazis. For 2 years, Conlon's been guest conducting American and European orchestras, performing works of composers killed in concentration camps or forced into hiding during the Holocaust. Recently, he conducted the Boston Symphony Orchestra in a performance of Victor Ullmann's Piano Concerto. Ullmann died in 1944 at Auschwitz, the camp which was liberated 60 years ago this week. That's composer Victor Ullmann's Piano Concerto, performed last week at Boston Symphony Hall under the direction of guest conductor James Conlon, who sat down with Here and Now producer April Peavy.
Victor Ullmann composed over 20 compositions in a two-year period between 1942 and 44, at which point he was sent to Auschwitz. But the other names, Pavel Haas, Hans Krause, Gideon Klein, are also important names. The name of Erwin Schulhoff, another Czech Jewish composer who died in a concentration camp in Würzburg. These are only some of these composers, and in fact there are literally hundreds and hundreds of pieces that were simply never played.
And it's my understanding at the concentration camp Terezin, composers were allowed to, and musicians were allowed to compose and play their music.
Yes, Terezin was an old fortress which the Nazis then took over and turned it into a ghetto or a concentration camp. Early on, they decided that they were going to use this as a front for the Western world and that they were going to show this camp to the West in order to say, actually, there's nothing wrong with the camps. They're very humane. Look, here are happy citizens, and they are enjoying music. They're enjoying concerts. They have discussions. They read books. There's a library. In other words, the cultural life was encouraged, and it was all designed toward a culminating moment when the International Red Cross visited in July of 1944. After the Red Cross visited, they started to dismantle all of this, and then they accelerated the transports, mostly to Auschwitz. Victor Ullmann, Hans Krause, and Pavel Haas all died on the same day. They all went together.
Would you say that your motivation is political, or is it more artistic?
It's definitely artistic, and it is. It has a moral aspect, and it has an artistic aspect. The moral aspect is simply, if you can ever, at least I'm brought up this way by my parents, if you can undo an injustice, you should. If you can do something about injustice. I don't like according the Nazi regime a posthumous victory on this issue. So that is the moral aspect involved. But the moral aspect would not really have enough meaning if artistically the music was not of sufficient value and caliber And music lives by performance. So I don't think it's sufficient to give a doctoral thesis about it and say, well, it exists and it's there and these are these person's stories. I think it has to be done in a very natural, ongoing way.
Mention, if you will, a couple more composers whose works you've highlighted over the past year.
Erwin Schulhoff, he was one of the naughty boys of the post-First World War. The Dadaists like to shock their parents, wrote a lot of funny, witty pieces. Everything he wrote in the between 1915 and 1925 or 1929 reflects that. Then he became interested in Marxism. He started writing compositions about Marxism. That's a fascinating type of person, you know. Alexander Zemlinsky wrote magnificently for the orchestra and wrote 8 operas. He admired Wagner, he admired Strauss, but he had a voice of his own, and he made that voice heard.
Traveled all over the world conducting these particular pieces that haven't been heard for so many years. What is the overall response that you get?
I find that it strikes a chord almost everywhere I go these days, with the musicians on the stage. Many, many orchestras have participated in this project in such a way, and I find almost invariably that the musicians themselves are very taken with it, and that transmits itself to the public.
Have you heard from any of the composer's descendants?
That's a nice question, and one very touching story. Carl Amadeus Hartmann, who was from Munich, was one of the first dissenters against Hitler, knew about Hitler from the time of the Putsch. So when Hitler became chancellor, he immediately was singled out as somebody that the Nazis did not want to see. So he basically went underground. Not being Jewish, he was never taken into a concentration camp, but he basically hid himself away in Munich for the entire time of the war. Now, in 1938, he wrote a violin concerto called Concert Funèbre, which starts with a very quiet hymn taken from a Hussite hymn, which is a Czech hymn, which is a symbol of Czech resistance, and dedicated to his one-year-old son, whose name was Richard. I conducted this piece 2 years ago in Munich, and when the concert was over, there was a knock on my dressing room door, and there was a very, very gentle, smiling man, and he introduced and he said, "I'm Richard Hartmann. This piece was written for me." I said, "I know exactly who you are." I was very touched. We had a wonderful conversation. And then he said, "By the way, my mother sends her greetings. She knows everything you've been doing, and she is too old to come to the concert. But if you would give her a call, she'd be thrilled." I didn't know she was alive. So I spoke to her the next day on the telephone. She was a woman in her mid-90s, still alive. That, to me, is very touching. That means so much, and it means so much to them.
The word hero, you really have rescued them from obscurity.
That's very kind of you, but I really can't take any of that credit. I haven't discovered anything. It's all been that. This has been the work of many people, many wonderful musicologists and caring people. I'm just somebody who has become passionately involved and passionately convinced that there are those of us who are performing musicians who need to bring our weight to bear so that the pieces get performed. So I'm trying my best to be instrumental in making that happen.
Conductor James Conlin speaking with Here and Now producer April Peavy. For more information and a list of the music you just heard, check out our website at here-now.org. a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.